Don't you deserve a Medicare plan you can count on? Well, you can count on a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. Enjoy reliable coverage and low out-of-pocket costs with a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. And if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, chronic heart failure, or a cardiovascular disorder, you may qualify for a UnitedHealthcare Complete Care plan with plans that fit your life today and as your needs change tomorrow. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare plans at uhc.com/Medicare.
With your host, Andrew Donaldson, this is Heard Tell.
All good. Welcome back to Heard Tell. We're going to do some movies because I just wrote 1,600 words about tariffs, and to hell with that. Let's talk some movies. We have in our rotation, he took a little break over the summer, Luis Mendez, Mendez Movie Report, three-time board certified film critic. He can also talk to business and not just his opinion. Way, way better than your average letterbox user. How's that for an introduction, buddy? Did I get it all covered?
I would say so. It's nice to know that I'm more informed than the average letterbox user, but in my ego, I will say I don't disagree.
And your humble but accurate opinion is the line I stole from somebody years ago. All right, buddy, we did this a year ago. I went and looked real quick. Last year, one of the worst Memorial Day weekend box offices of all time. This year, a historically good Memorial Day weekend box office of all time. Do we just overthink this stuff? Is it just as simple as make good movies and people will come see the good movies and we kind of overthink it and put more stuff on it than it really is? Is that oversimplification? Is that where we're at on this? How do you explain last year to this year? Is it just better movies? Because I think that might just be the whole key of the whole thing.
Well, I mean, last year, I think the problem was that it was all they banked Memorial Day weekend on a Garfield animated film and Furiosa. And the reason Furiosa didn't do so hot is because the Mad Max franchise has historically, it's got its fans, it's left its imprint in cinema, but those movies generally don't make the kind of money that the kind of movies that are making money for this weekend do. And so I think that was a big part of it. Even Mad Max Fury Road, which went on to be an Oscar contending film, didn't make that kind of money. That being said, I do think Furiosa is a better movie than the movies we got this year. While I think word of mouth helps a lot, we saw that earlier this year with Sinners. If word of mouth is good enough and strong enough, people keep coming, this will be willing to check something out, especially if you don't let the theatrical window be so narrow. You know, people will be like, well, the only way I can experience this is to actually go to the theater and watch it. In terms of why I think this box office is better this year, is because I think it's a better Perfect Storm. You have the Lilo and Stitch remake. And on top of that, you have a Mission Impossible movie, and not just any other Mission Impossible movie, but what's supposed to be the finale to the entire series. So you end up with this perfect storm of a remake to what has been a beloved millennial classic. A lot of those millennials now have their own kids, and they've probably been making these kids have probably been watching on Disney Plus all the time. And so they go to see that, and other folks are get to go see Tom Cruise do Tom Cruise stuff with one last Mission Impossible film. So I think the difference is maybe not necessarily the quality in films so much as the marketability of the films in comparison to last year.
Do we undervalue cultural impact of films? And here's what I mean by that. It's not just that they were popular, people went and saw them. Lilo and Stitch had his own attraction at Disneyland for years. Like, you went to the Stitch thing where he escapes the lab, and you said that was an attraction at Disney World. That kind of stuff, you know, you're talking, what, 20 years of merchandise now. You just said it. Kids grew up watching that. Tom Cruise in an action movie, anybody that's you know, sentient knows Tom Cruise in an action movie is probably going to be, it may not be the best film. It's going to be really well made. It's going to be entertaining. It'll vary in quality a little bit, but the floor is really, really high on a Tom Cruise action movie. You know, you're not going to get burned on the experience, right? That's kind of cultural currency to movies that I think plays into how a box office performs now. You just said about Furiosa, Mad Max was something that people hadn't seen. It's like, oh, I'm going to take my kids and watch a Mad Max movie. Top Gun was like this. I'm going to take my kids and watch a Top Gun movie because I thought I'd never get to do that. That sort of thing. Lilo and Stitch. Oh, my kids never got to see this in theater. I'm going to go see it. But you had 20 years of built-in stuff going to it. Tom Cruise has cultural currency. I think when they try to launch these franchise tentpole kind of stuff or even a remake, that stuff really, really matters to a movie if it's going to be super successful beyond just that opening weekend and have a big drop-off, right?
Yes, and I think it's one of the various reasons why, say, the Snow White remake didn't do as well, because while everyone knows about the story of Snow White and that Snow White was the first animated film Disney did, I don't think it's left necessarily the kind of cultural mark in more recent generations compared to past. Even Sleeping Beauty sort of has something with the whole Maleficent of it all. You Snow White didn't have that. Lilo and Stitch does have even much more cultural resonance. And it's a big part in helping, you know, these remakes and spinoffs. And then when you get something like you get something like Furiosa, the problem is that there's IPs, but every IP has a ceiling on the kind of fandom or general interest that they can grab. I've said a million times, everybody who knows me knows I'm a massive Godzilla fan, but that does have a ceiling. The Godzilla movies are never going to make like Avengers money. So like when the last film made like over 600 million worldwide, that's really good for a Godzilla movie. So Furiosa, I think, always had a low ceiling, as most of the Mad Max movies do in comparison to a Mission Impossible or a Lilo and Stitch. And that's why for actual original films like Sinners, earlier this year, that word of mouth is so incredibly important compared to, okay, you've already got a built-in audience that will show up.
And I think we need to redefine the term. I just used it, so let me back up and redefine it. Family film. Family film means you want to take your family and see it. It's not just, oh, this is a cartoon made for kids. And I think the movie makers fall into this trap, and the marketing people definitely did, especially with Snow White. We'll get to that in a minute because that's kind of its own little thing. I think we need to redefine what a family film is now, because family time is very much sitting on the couch watching something on streaming. It's not going out and spending. Let's be honest, you're probably looking at probably upwards of $100 to take a family of four or five to a movie nowadays by the time you eat and do everything else, right? That's an expense. So if you're going to have a family-friendly film, it's got to be worth it. You got to have engagement in it. It's not just going to be, oh, this is for kids. The adults have got to want to see it. There's got to be buy-in. I think that's just terminology that needs to be redone. And Disney has always been the master of this, and it's easy to beat up on Disney. But I think Disney's kind of been the best at this. They're like, no, we're going to do the marketing. We're going to do the merchandise. We're going to bring things. Remember, before streaming, it was, when are we going to release things out of the vault? Every 5-6 years, you release one of them classic movies. They were the masters at keeping it in the consciousness every couple of years, those intellectual properties, right? The reason we know about Snow White and Cinderella and all that, they released it every 4 or 5 years on VHS and then on DVD and then on streaming and then in a deluxe packet. They knew how to build this stuff up. And a lot of these new movies, they just think it's a cartoon movie. No, family stuff is now a multi-generational thing for these intellectual properties. And when it hits, it's huge. And if you don't get that buy-in, they just aren't going to show up and spend that kind of money for it. Is that a fair way to lay it out?
I mean, yes, I think that's fair, particularly with Disney, because Disney are the absolute masters. And I haven't really seen any studio pull this off as well as they have. They've talked about it. They've done some things here and there, but they haven't pulled it off in the way that Disney has, in that Disney always makes sure that what they create is almost like part of this grander legacy, so that can be passed down to generations. And, you know, like when I grew up, you know, my parents were showing me the Disney films they grew up with. And then I started, like I don't have any kids, but I have nieces or nephews, and I'm telling them to check out the movies that I grew up with watching from Disney. If I go to the Disney parks, I immediately have a connection to the Disney characters, particularly the ones that I grew up with. Compare that to say a Universal. Universal has their own parks. They're basically having to buy up IPs from not just their own movies but other movies. Whereas Disney's like, well, we can build it on our own, and they've done such a good job of doing this. Now, does it always work? Is it always a critical hit? Is it always a box office hit? No, but more times than not, you know, it's sort of part of this big behemoth of theirs, and they've been able to just turn it into this, to sort of this just big, almost cinematic universe of theirs without their characters necessarily having to interact with each other. And there's a lot of studios that have tried to tinker and try to replicate that, but Disney are the only ones who have really pulled it off. And to be fair to the other studios, Disney did kind of have decades upon decades to pull this off, going all the way back to when Walt started doing animation back in the late 20s. But they've done it masterfully.
Let me tell you a Disney story real quick. When I was running trucks for a freight company, we delivered to the Disney store at the mall locally. Remember when we had the Disney stores? And it was when Frozen blew up and became I think at the time it was one of the biggest Disney films ever. And remember, the soundtrack's what was driving it. And my driver is delivering a pallet of the soundtrack CDs to the Disney store because he couldn't get them anywhere else because it was all sold out. And he calls me and goes, I can't get in the store. And I'm like, it's locked. Or the guy, he's like, no, there's a riot. There's so many people here. I can't physically get in the store. And they're attacking the pallet. When I try to take it in the store, they actually came around the back looking for it. They're so desperate. I've got all these moms chasing me around. What do I do? I was like, well, just sit tight for a minute. So he's about 20 minutes late on this delivery. I get a phone call, and the caller ID is 500 South Buena Vista Street, Burbank, California, from Huntington, West Virginia's area. That's how on top of their stuff a Disney store at a mall in West Virginia and Burbank headquarters within 20 minutes of being late, they're calling to find out why it ain't there. Yes. All right. That's how militant they used to be with their, the joke in logistics was always don't mess with Walmart and don't mess with the mouse, because you're going to get a phone call from Burbank if you screw that stuff up. That's how on top of their logistics and their marketing and their brand development. And if you've ever been to, I had a buddy of mine that worked at Walt Disney World as a character staff. He's like, look, everything is public facing. Don't mess it up, because they are that protective of the brand. Now, some of that's fallen off the Marvel stuff, and we know Star Wars got a little messy and all that. But the thing with that is people my age that are in their mid 40s now, and my kids are adults, my kids have a hard and fast understanding of what the Disney brand is, and very few brands have that, even with all the troubles they're having. But that really matters when it comes to business, because, you know, it's almost like a, I don't even know what to compare it to. I guess it's like a, you know, if you have an insurance annuity that you kept for 40 years and your parents passed it to you, as long as you don't touch it, that baby's going to print money for you.
Yeah. And that's exactly what they've been able to pull off. I mean, again, they've had stumbles, but when you're a multi-billion dollar company, you can afford a couple stumbles. And Disney, they have their own, they do have some ongoing issues. The MCU isn't as hot as it used to be. Star Wars, like you said, is a bit of a mess. And then there's been a lot of criticism of late that the parks are getting not affordable to get to be able to enjoy more. But they still are a multi-billion dollar company. And I remember back in 2023, there was a lot of talk of they didn't have their hottest year, and people were starting to say, oh, is Disney starting to fall? Is Disney starting to fall out? And what's happened is that we're now going on 2 years straight now where they've once again flexed their muscles at the box office.
There's nothing I like more than busting up a stupid narrative. There's this narrative in the media. I know Business Insider ran it. I think Deadline had a piece about it. It's like, oh, Lilo and Stitch did well. Disney has learned their lesson from Snow White. Okay, I went and looked. These movies were produced at the exact same time. So, no, they didn't. They were just made by different people, marketed different. And we know about the Rachel Ziegler stuff and all that. that's the kind of lazy reporting on this stuff that really kind of drives me a little bit nuts of like, no, they were made at the exact same time. In fact, Lilo and Stitch was actually, they finished it before the Snow White one because they had to go back and fix all the Snow White stuff. Talk about that process a little bit, because one of the reasons I like talking movies with you is you actually understand the business of it and the A to B to C, and understand that what's in the theater is step X. There's a lot of steps to that. But walk through folks through that, because if a movie has a problem like Snow White did, it creeps up during developmental and it creeps up after those initial screenings and when they're cutting it and when they're rewriting. There's warning signs when they start doing reshoots or when they delay a movie. Talk through that process as a film critic, because you look for that stuff. Those are red flags. They don't usually pop up in the normal media until it's, oh, the box office was bad. But you usually can see those things coming with things like that, right? Because there's red flags in the developmental process, or it gets delayed, or we've seen with the MCU universe, they've had to ditch entire multi-film things because of certain things, the Jonathan Majors situation, that sort of stuff. Talk about that part of it, because we don't see that until it hits the headlines, but you're watching those. These train wrecks are usually kind of predictable, right?
Well, I mean, and sometimes you can see it in the marketing, but I mean, look, if you follow the news on development and things that are getting produced, you can tell when something is taking a little bit too long, there's something that doesn't look right. And on top of that, sometimes you get sources on a film. I've talked to some certain sources about some upcoming movies. I remember, I think it was about a month ago, I was talking to a source about the new Karate Kid movie, and they were telling me how bad it was, and it looks like the movie's getting some rough reviews. I haven't gotten to see it yet. I'm hoping to today. Yeah, I mean, sometimes you can see it coming. In terms of the way that the media covers it, though, that drives me crazy, too, because it feels like every year, seemingly, at the start of the year, there's sort of this the world is coming to an end, the industry is not making money, nobody's coming to see movies, and then inevitably we start getting better movies, the summer box office comes along, and all of a sudden everybody's talking about these record breakers and stuff like that. Of course, some of this record breaking is thanks to inflation, because if you adjust it for inflation, it maybe doesn't look as impressive. But this happens all the time, where there's always this the sky is falling, and then all of a sudden, 2 weeks later, a movie does better than the new movie that came out. So all of a sudden, oh, the industry is saved again. I mean, Ted Sarandos, who runs Netflix, over on Film Twitter, we've really been beating him up, because he made a comment about, the new way to watch movies is Netflix. Nobody goes to the theater anymore. And literally ever since he said that, the box office has been having great week after great week. And so it wasn't the greatest timing by Ted. But that happens all the time with the way that this is reported. In terms of the Snow White and Lilo and Stitch situation, which, by the way, it's interesting that originally both of those movies were supposed to release on streaming. Thank God for Disney's bottom line that they didn't, because they were going to make more money now, even with Snow White not necessarily making the money that they thought it was going to make. So they actually ended up making more money by not releasing into streaming, at least having a theatrical release first. But the thing about these Disney live action remakes is that they are done separately with different visions, with different scripts. Live action remakes are really sort of like, everybody's got their different views on them. Everybody's got divisive views on each. Nobody's really got a similar like personal ranking of them. They all are different. There are some that I think have been so beat for beat that there's almost a lifelessness to them. There are some that I think have made some differences to the source material that helped the movie a little. There are some that I think made changes in source material that hurt the movie. So it really wasn't a situation where Disney learned from many mistakes. They made two movies at the same time. One was a better ended up doing more financially better than the other. And quite frankly, if to put on my critic's hat on, I don't think either is that particularly good, but audiences obviously responded to one better than the other.
Is the debate over the live action remakes? Let me phrase it this way. I don't like live action remakes. I'm already having the fight with my family over How to Train a Dragon remake that's getting ready to come out because they love those. My 19-year-old was watching them, did a marathon of them the other day. They love those movies. So you have to go to this one because you know me, I'm picky about what movies I want to go to. Is the live action remake of animated film, and again, How to Train Your Dragon isn't a Disney property, but they obviously looked at that money pile and went, hey, we can get in on that. Is the debate helping, hurting, or neutral to the actual box office performings of these? Because I think the debate has gone on so long now, it's like, okay, well, there's the old thing of there's no such thing as bad publicity. So if you're talking about it, maybe people will go to see it to see if it's any good or not. Where do you fall on it? Because they're going to keep doing this. Eventually they'll run out, I guess. But then we could have the live action remakes of the live action remakes, I guess. Or they'll, you know, are they going to do the thing where they do the animated remake of the live action remake of the animated remake? Is the debate of it driving it? Is it hurting it? Is it helping it? Is it just background noise now? Where do you fall on all this? Because we've been doing it for a while and we're going to do it for at least a couple more years, it seems like.
My thinking has always been that I honestly don't think general audiences really care all that much about the whole debate about the live action remakes. I would think that there's a group of audiences that question the reason these things exist. In terms of what I think the debate doesn't really affect Disney's bottom dollar or their decision to green light this stuff. General audiences clearly show up for most of these movies. There's been some like Dumbo or Snow White that didn't show up big for. I mean, some of these have made $1 billion. I mean, the Lion King movie made like $1.5 billion, and that movie did not have good reviews. Mufasa made, I think, like over $700 million. That movie also didn't have the greatest reviews. So these remakes and spinoffs, I don't think general audiences care about the debate. I do think who cares about the debate in particular seems to be real hardcore cinephiles and film critics, to a point that I do think that one of the things that I think unfairly these Disney live action remixes and spinoffs have to face is that I do wonder, like, there's going to be some critics who walk into these movies and they've already got a gripe against just the fact they exist. And my take has always been to try to take each individual movie and judge it on its own merit. I mean, at the end of the day, the question is to why do these movies exist? They exist because of money. That's why. I mean, they're going to keep doing these until we get more consistent Snow Whites. Lilo and Stitch is just reminding us that there's still an audience out there for these. As long as you get the ones that people would actually have some kind of connection to. I mean, they're already giving us a Moana live action remake next year, and that movie is only been going on 10 years old. That's to me where it really is starting to get out of control. I mean, if you want to try to remake some films from old 30s, 40s, 50s Disney animated films, I'm kind of open to that. But now you're remaking movies that came out while I was alive. And while I wouldn't say I'm a young man, I'm also not an old man. I don't think it really affects audiences. I do think it potentially could affect some of its critical reviews, because I do talk to a lot of critics who just have this very fervent hatred of the existence of these movies before they even talk about whether they like the movie or not. And I do think that that has to affect the movie's reviews to some respect. That being said, As someone who has been a soft defender of some of these films in the past, I do feel that of late I'm seeing more consistent what I would think is lower quality of these movies, and I think maybe that the Disney machine is not maybe putting as much care into them if they know they're just going to make a quick buck out of them.
You just hit something important there, and we're picking on Disney here, but they're the biggest guy on the block right now. But this is happening in other studios and whatever. That's something else that's changed we need to talk about sometime. There's not as many studios as there used to be. That's part of the problem, but that's another topic for another day. Disney really seems to just outsource these movies until they show up with the final product, and then they just start tinkering with them. So they're picking the directors and the producers, the actual shot callers, not just the people that are getting their name put on there so they can get a residual check. They seem to be outsourcing this stuff more, not doing the quality control on the entire project start to finish. And then when they bring the movie in to distribute it, they're like, no, we want to change this, that, and the other. That's a break from how they used to do things. And that's a break from how the studios used to do things. There was always the ones that would just do the, get it out and make your buck. Is that pressure from the streaming stuff? Is that pressure from the COVID area of we got to get some really high stuff out? Maybe we can make up for, quantity with quality and vice versa. Is that an effect that's happening? Because it sure, Disney would have never just let a director do whatever they want with a film 20 years ago. That wouldn't have happened. They would have been involved from the go. And yet it seems to be happening, and that's why you get films that seem so divergent, but they're made at the same time by the same studio.
Well, I mean, studio meddling has been a thing going all the way back to the beginning of film. But
it's not always a bad thing. Some of these directors need reeled in. We've seen it happen, right? There's a balance.
Oh, I agree. I mean, the debate around that, particularly among film critics and cinephiles, is, well, even if you just let a film director just do whatever the heck they want and it's not a good product, well, at the very least, they got their vision out and it didn't work for everyone. But look, it's a subjective art, and I can respect that. But at the same time, if you're a big studio and you're trying to, at the end of the day, you are trying to make a profit off of these films, you're going to have to reel these folks back a little. Obviously, the more successful a film director is, the more they're going to have leeway. But like, for instance, Mickey 17 came out earlier this year from Warner Brothers, and it's from Bong Joon-ho, who is the director of Parasite. He's also directed other great movies like Memories of Murder that I would recommend people go check out. But this is like a quirky, comedic sci-fi film, and the studio tried to meddle with it. He wouldn't let them. And the final product that you got was, quite frankly, a movie that is not going to be seen as one of his best films. And watching it, I knew right away, okay, I can see why Warner Brothers lost confidence in this. It's a kind of a debate on itself about just letting the artists get their work out. And then, of course, at the end of the day, the studio being, yes, but we're investing in this because we're hoping to make a profit off of this. So we need to make sure that it's palatable to some audience out there, a sizable audience at least. In terms of Disney, I mean, I do think, for instance, to talk about Lilo and Stitch, I think Disney's meddling may have hurt the movie, if anything, in that situation. Lilo and Stitch is directed by Dean Fleischer Camp, who directed Marcel the Shell with Shoes On, which is one of my favorite films of 2022. And we started getting some news out there about some of the things that he didn't get to do that he wanted to do with the movie because of Disney. And I do think studio meddling can definitely hurt a movie. And I think studios can freak out a little bit too much. And before you know it, when you got the director having a vision, the studio has a vision, there's so much a clash, you try to compromise, and sometimes it works, and sometimes you just end up with a mess that a lot of people don't end up liking. So it's kind of a catch-22 situation of how much studios should be left to meddle.
Talking about studios, you follow this stuff. I don't. The Cannes Film Festival just happened. Look, it's self-indulgent. This is the dense center of the film world black hole that has a lot of gravitational pull. I think it's up to 12 days now. It used to be like 3 or 4. Now it's 12 days. Look, they're very French, the French. It's very self-indulgent. You have 20-minute standing ovations, which they're just now doing for the sake of how can we have the longest standing ovation. It's very self-indulgent. However, there is stuff that spins out of that very inclusive universe that ends up in front of us, the general public, too. Tell people a couple of the things to watch for coming out of that, besides, you know, for the folks that don't know what a Palme d'Or is, and I don't think I even said that right, but let folks know why you cover it and what the connection to the average theater is, because it doesn't look like it, but these are people that are very influenced by other people that are like them, and this is when all the influencers kind of get together. This is kind of one of those, you know, drops in the puddle that has ripple effects out. Talk about cons for just a second, why you cover it, and why, and if at all, people should care about such things.
Oh, but well, look, there's various film festivals. The most important film festivals to really striking a chord into what's going to be in awards, what's going to strike a chord in awards season are the fall film festivals. They're also more populous. Their movies in the fall festivals tend to be more accessible, and they're definitely more American. The Cannes Film Festival is more about what are going to be the first chess pieces to the upcoming awards season, and they tend to be predominantly international films. Now, the Cannes Film Festival has, in the last couple of years, has become very important in launching some would-be awards contenders, and even some movies that ended up leaving a cultural mark with some mainstream viewers. We've, in the last 6 years, two Best Picture winners have come out of Cannes, Parasite and Anora, Top Gun Maverick premiered at Cannes, The Substance premiered at Cannes. There has been some effect on the mainstream culture from Cannes, but mainly Cannes tends to be the place to be for a lot of international films, particularly films that hardcore cinephiles or film critics are going to really try to push, that maybe general audiences maybe aren't really that aware even exists. So I've always considered Cannes to be almost like the dipping of your toes into what awards season could look like, or what movies are going to be recommended at the end of the year as among the best of the year. This year in particular, it was really dominated by international films. And Neon, who has been really used Cannes to be their bread and butter in ways that all the other indie studios really haven't, they have now won 6 straight festivals now with movies that they've acquired or already helped produce. And out of Cannes, it was just an accident won at Cannes the big prize, which is an Iranian film. It's a thriller about a couple who get involved in a car crash, and some folks think that he might have been an officer that tortured them. It's a movie that has something to say about some of the political regime in Iran. The director has faced political prosecution in Iran. It's a movie that I'm keeping my eyes on. However, the Academy doesn't have the greatest record of responding to Middle Eastern films, so you also want to keep an eye on Sentimental Value, which is a Nordic film. It's sort of a comedy drama about a filmmaking father who's attempting to make a movie about his family. There's also Surat, a Spanish language film about a father who's trying to find his daughter, his missing daughter. There's Resurrection, which is a Chinese film that is apparently supposed to be sort of an homage to classical horror. It's sort of got this sort of post-apocalyptic vampire thing going for it. There's The Secret Agent, a Brazilian movie that touches on some of the stuff from the 1970s dictatorship there. So those are the movies that seem to land the most. The most American film that I would say landed out of there was probably Highest to Lowest, which is Spike Lee's remake of High and Low, which got good but not necessarily great reactions. So this year's Cannes Festival was really dominated by international films that, quite frankly, a lot of mainstream audiences probably won't see. So as far as I'm concerned, a lot of the top films that maybe are going to be talked about and ran for awards, we're probably still waiting until the fall festivals to see what those are going to be. But this year ended up being a very international affair over at Cannes.
Talking about international, in the past, the last probably 10, 15 years. International box office was really bailing out the domestic box office as far as the film studios, especially China, Asia markets, things like that. The tariff stuff and the economic stuff, that has changed it. And then the political climate around China has changed somewhat, where we've seen studios just kind of skip China in some areas. Now, you get somebody like a Disney, that's a little bit of a different beast because they really count on the Asian markets dominated by China. Do you see anything changing in that? I think they backed off it for the political moment, but long-term, I don't think they can leave that pile of money just laying there no matter what the politics and geopolitics and economic turmoil involved in. Do you see kind of a realignment coming in the international box office? Because that's still more money than they're going to make domestic almost no matter what they do, right?
Yeah, I mean, the big studios are definitely going to try to make it happen. We just got some announcements. For instance, Superman has been greenlit to have a release in China. They're still trying to – the big studios definitely still want to do that, especially considering that the international market, as you've said, has bailed out certain big franchises. There are movies that would have done much worse if they only released in the States, but were helped out big time by the Chinese box office. Now, there are other movies that did better in the States and internationally, but it sort of depends. I've noticed a certain pattern. Particularly for like superhero movies or sort of dumb entertainment, shut your brain off popcorn flicks, those tend to really rely on the international markets to really pump up those numbers. I'm keeping an eye out on it, particularly because knowing the way that the industry is, if there's suddenly this feeling that there's a war against international films, maybe that could create the perfect storm where the industry rallies to an international film to win Best Picture from the awards standpoint of it. But so far, it does seem like there's been some backing off going on. If anyone is going to try to do their damnedest to make sure that this doesn't affect their bottom dollar, it's going to be the big studios. Disney, Warner Brothers, and Universal in particular.
Real quick on Universal, their IPs, you've talked about, they've gone on kind of a buying spree. They're starting to farm out into streaming. We know the Harry Potter casting is out now. That's going to be a debate coming up. And of course, the politics that surround all that. Where are they in the ecosystem now? Because, you know, it's not that Disney's lighting the world on fire, even though they're having periodical success. It looks like the new Marvel stuff is going to be a little bit of a mess. The Star Wars is a little bit up in the air. But Universal doesn't seem to actually be getting a whole lot of traction against them in the big picture long-term marathon race. They're keeping up maybe, but they don't seem to be gaining, and they are spending gobloads of money. Do you think they're pushing to more streaming things? They're rehashing their intellectual properties a little bit more. The park's doing really well, but that daggone thing's getting expensive. I just looked that up the other day. Where are they at in this ecosystem? Because they're kind of been little brother status trying to rise up, but are they going to be little brother status that gets a little sideways trying to keep up when they probably shouldn't be?
I think they might be at an inflection point, and we'll have to wait and see what happens for them, because I do feel that they've been slowly and quietly climbing up there. But while Disney has had some mess ups, but they're still peaking, no one's reaching them anytime soon. And Warner Brothers has had some slip ups. Warner Brothers is a whole other issue, because even though they have Barbie, they had the success with Barbie, they've had success with the MonsterVerse films. They've also had up and down successes. Color Purple didn't do as well as they wanted. The DC films have been very hit or miss for them so far. They're obviously hoping that with this new sort of change in leadership over there with the Superman film, that they can get that on track. But Universal's been doing really good. They've been, even with their like indie stuff, they've been doing a little bit, they've been doing good. I mean, Conclave ended up being the small box office hit. They won Best Picture and did incredibly well with the box office with Oppenheimer. They've got Wicket was a big hit. They got another Wicket coming. They've got they've got this How to Train Your Universal has How to Train Your Dragon, because it's a DreamWorks property. So they have the How to Train Your Dragon live action remake that they're hoping. I mean, they want to full blown do all three movies in live action. So they obviously have big hopes for that. So they've been quietly climbing up there with some success. Will it be long term? We'll have to wait and see. They are making very big investments. So I am keeping an eye out on them. They've really been climbing of late.
Yeah, Luis Mendez, Mendez Movie Report. Let's actually go to your Mendez Movie Report on the Substack. We'll link to it. Let's just do some quick hit reviews real quick. Give me a couple thoughts on some of the movies you've reviewed lately, because that's what you do best. We already hit Lilo and Stitch, so we won't beat that to death. Interesting one, kind of conceptually, Fountain of Youth, big name director, huge name cast, a lot of money, kind of a, you know, traditional Romancing the Stone kind of genre for the last 45. Man, I'm dating myself busting out Romancing the Stone, but that's what started all this mess. You know what I'm talking about. Fountain of Youth, it's on streaming. You felt like it had a lot of expensive toys, but didn't quite come together.
No, I mean, there's been a lot of jokes that it's almost like a Guy Ritchie's attempt at doing National Treasure, except this is more globally than just sort of a treasure hunt for U.S. stuff. It's got a great cast and everything, but it's honestly, for what should be an adventure film, it's kind of dull for the most part. John Krasinski, he can pull off the whole deadpan smart aleck humor, as we saw with The Office, and in other roles that he's done. But they're really asking him to pull off the whole sort of like likable smart ass jerk thing. And he ain't no Robert Downey Jr. and he ain't no Chris Pratt. He is really miscasting this. Most of the movies, him and his sister, played by Natalie Portman, just kind of bickering. There's a twist that happens towards the end of the movie that feels like it was predictable and yet somehow still felt like it was really tacked on. Almost like they just came up with it as they wrote the movie. It really is, I think, the worst Guy Ritchie film since King Arthur. And it's a shame because while I don't necessarily love his movies, I do think Guy Ritchie, he has this personality to his movies that make them pretty enjoyable. And unfortunately, this is a big miss.
We talked about it a little bit, but we didn't talk about the actual film, Mission Impossible Final Reckoning. Did Tom Cruise stick the landing, pun intended?
He kind of did, because the biggest problem with the movie that has had some critics to have issues with it is the first hour of the film. The first hour of the film is basically flashbacks, constantly like trying to put everything together, going all the way back to the first film. There are some callbacks that feel forced, and there are some callbacks that I thought were really cool, particularly in a character of William Dunlow, who was the CIA guy who broke into the data room in the first film for that iconic scene. They brought him back and did something really cool with him that really, I think, kind of put a full circle of part one to this one. There are certain callbacks in the other parts of the movie that maybe feel more forced. The villain isn't particularly great. Unfortunately, I do feel like the franchise kind of peaked in terms of storytelling potential with 5 and 6. To kind of end up in a situation where Ethan Hunt is battling a sentient AI, I feel like that's something that should be more of a Marvel thing. But that being said, it still has great stunts. It still has puts everything together in a way that tries to tie the bow on this franchise. It's still got some emotional moments. There's two big set pieces that are really impressive. There's where Tom is literally trying to get in and get out of a submarine before it collapses on from the ocean, from sort of this ocean cliff down to the abyss. And one where he's literally on a biplane trying to get to the bad guy and he doesn't have the parachute or anything on, which has really had me on the edge of my seat as someone who's not a big fan of heights. It's overlong. There's a little bit too many flashbacks, but at the end of the day, I did think it's a fun popcorn flick. If you're a big Mission Impossible fan, I do think it's a fun trip to the movies.
Yeah, anytime Tom Cruise is falling off something, it's usually a pretty decent film, at least for, you know, a few minutes. Here's a film property that I just frankly despise and avoid like the plague, but they busted out another Final Destination and they tried to do some retconning and put all these different movies together that were never intended to be a franchise, but wound up being one anyway, because everything's stupid and who knows why these things happen. But people, there are people that like these things. I don't like them. I find them pretentious, but Final Destination Bloodlines, what say you?
Yeah, I'm in the minority because this movie did get good reviews and it's gotten pretty decent audience scores. I did not like this movie, even though I did appreciate that they tried to do something different by creating sort of this family dynamic and drama with this movie. My issue with the Final Destination films is that I like the idea and the concept of, okay, you cheated Death and now Death is angry and coming after you. And you could do so many things with that where you can talk about mortality and how much should you fear death or accept death. Is there different ways that you can overcome death? Is there, if these kids who are supposed to have these premonitions, is there something giving them premonitions? There's sort of like this sort of like life. Is there a way that you can battle death with life? And even though they try to do a little bit of that with the lore throughout the movie, for the most part, all these movies are the same. Somebody has a premonition, death starts killing these characters off in crazy ways. It seems like they found a way to avoid it. Boom, there's a twist. Everybody dies at the end. And it's just like, I feel like if you've seen one of these movies, you've seen them all. And after all of these films, I keep hoping that they'll expand the lore and do something with what they can do with this franchise. And instead, they just keep doing the bare minimum. So I was not a fan of the newest Final Destination.
All right, let's go back just a little bit, dipping into your rundown of the drink. But again, big names in the film, but a streamer. Didn't see a lot of promotion of it, but The Gorge.
Oh, I like this to an extent. I did think the action was kind of very standard, but the romance aspect to it, I really dug. The concept is basically that there are these creatures who are climbing up this gorge, and they have to be shot down by two sides, one American, one Russian. And what happens is that the two agents who are stuck with this job end up falling in love. They end up falling into the gorge and they have to fight their way out. I thought it was a pretty okay movie, nothing that wild or spectacular. I wish they did a little bit more on the romance, but I definitely better use of your time if you have an Apple TV Plus than found in a U.
There's the key to it. Can you find it? All right, one more, and this one is kind of I find this interesting in a meta sense, big picture, and you can explain it a little bit, but there was a time not long ago in my lifetime where if Steven Soderbergh put out a movie, that would be the headline and the movie title would be like three lines down from that. But he put out a film that you really liked. It's on streaming, Black Bag, really big name cast. You know, they didn't spare any expense making this thing, but you'd have to go Google it to find out that it's a Sondheim movie. That's amazing to me, but that's also kind of indicative of where we're at on some of this stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Soderbergh's starting to pump out one or two movies a year at this point. For a while, I've found a lot of his stuff to be okay. I don't feel like he's really hit the highs that he did during the 2000s. This, to me, was his best film in a long time. This is at the moment, as we are recording this, by the end of May, this is my favorite film of the year so far. This is a spy flick, but it's a spy flick that deals with sort of like the sort of co-worker and marriage dynamics. It's basically about Michael Fassbender plays a spy who's told, hey, we may have had a leak that could cost the lives of millions of people. And by the way, one of the people that we suspect could be the leak is your own wife, who is also a spy. So there's sort of this thriller aspect to it. It's not, I think the movie has gotten okay audience scores. And I think that's because it's not like a spy movie where there's action adventure happening all over the place. It really is a talky movie, and that's not going to be for everybody. But it really is a movie that I've watched multiple times. It has to it has a style to it. It's also a movie that's super pro monogamy, which I think more movies need to be of these days, because I'm getting sick and tired of all these love triangles. It's just a very slick and stylish spy film that is really sort of like a relationship drama that I really loved. It's so far my favorite film of the year.
I remember when the Ocean's 11 came out, I remember reading a review on Sondheim, and one of the things they said about him is like, when there's talking and then pauses, you know, it's one of his good movies.
Yes.
You know, and he was comparing it to Tarantino, where it's just, you know, like if it's just a constant stream of talking, we're in trouble. Looking at you, Hateful Eight. But the Soderbergh, they said if there's talking and then pauses, you know you're in for a good one. And it seems like that kind of held up here.
Yeah. I mean, this, like I said, this is easily his best film, I think, in quite a while. It's unfortunate that it's not going to end up getting any awards love or anything like that. But hey, I'm definitely going to be championing it when I do my best of the year list.
Just because you brought it up, what do we do with Fassbender? He's had a kind of an interesting career where he's like, they try to make him the it guy. He's not the it guy, but everything he does, he's good in, but he doesn't always have the best projects to be in. Where do you kind of rank him right now? Because he seems to maybe been finding a little bit, maybe it's because the streamers are wanting big names that will do some of these projects. And this thing's stacked up. Pierce Brosnan's in it. But what do you do with somebody like him? He seems to have maybe have figured out this project picking thing in the streaming world all of a sudden, because everything he's in, it may not be the best stuff, but he's good in it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he took a little bit of a break, and I think that was good for him, and now he's been dipping his toes back in. I think he should really keep doing this work with smaller films and more auteur directors, because I think that's his bag. I really liked him in The Killer, which was one of my favorite films of 2023, and he is very good in Black Bag. He's the main character of that film and really holds it up, so that he makes you buy that someone would potentially do light treason just to save their marriage. So he's really good, and I hope he keeps doing work with these actors and doing these smaller films.
All right, buddy, we always ask you this. Give us a couple to look forward to. Kind of the big topic stuff, the Mission Impossible is out, but what are we looking for through the rest of the summer movie season and on streaming, and anything else you've got for us to be paying attention to next couple of weeks?
Well, summer, obviously we have the How to Train Your Dragon live action remake. That'll be interesting to see. I actually got invited to a screening that I'm not going to be able to make that screening, which it's always nice to actually watch it with an audience, though, to really get sort of their perspective on it, instead of sitting in a room with a bunch of critics and no one's really responding to the film. In terms of other stuff coming out this summer, we have Ballerina, which is supposed to be a spinoff of John Wick. We have a movie that I'm very cautiously optimistic for, Jurassic World Rebirth. It looks like they're actually going to go back to doing what works with the Jurassic movies and doing the more survival horror aspect to it. No more going to the city. They're going back to the island. Fantastic Four, First Steps. I've heard that this is going to be the first truly great Fantastic Four movie, so I'm gonna hope for that. Superman, I really don't know how to feel about this movie, because the marketing hasn't really told us much, but I'm hopeful for that one. And Life of Chuck is, in terms of a smaller film, we've got Life of Chuck coming out in a couple of weeks. It's an adaptation of a Stephen King short story. I've heard it's very good. It won the TIFF Festival last year. It's supposed to be life-affirming and a feel-good movie. It's not your typical Stephen King horror. So those are the summer films that really come out to me. And coming out just outside of summer in September, we are going to get Paul Thomas Anderson's newest hit, One Battle After Another, which may be potentially a major contender It's going to be a political satire that really tries to hit at our current politics. And I've heard from a source that it's really good. And I'm a big PTA fan, so I'm looking forward to that one.
All right. Let it not be said that I won't take constructive criticism. Friends hold friends accountable. So here's your shot to take accountability of me, my friend. I have been just absolutely catching hell on social media because I have just been banging on this Superman movie and the Fantastic Four movie, and everybody's excited about it. Well, a lot of people are excited about it. And I've just been getting dragged every time I bring it up, like, you don't understand how hopeful Superman is. And you don't, and I'm like, there's been 11 Supermen in my lifetime. 11 different, and that's not counting Supergirl and all the other, and that's not counting alternate universes, and we don't know what the WB was doing there for a few years, so we'll put that to the side. But look, what do we do with Superman and Fantastic Four? Because you just said it, you're hopeful. I want this to work. I'm happy about this, but I'm like, man, this is like the third or fourth version of Fantastic Four I've sat through, and that's not counting the comics, which I'm old enough to remember. Where this is now going to be the 11th Superman I've seen it. I'm not interested. I don't care. I don't want to see it. Am I being too grumpy about this? Because people are telling me I'm being too grumpy, but I'm just like, nah, man, it's 30, 40 years of this stuff. I'm just kind of, eh.
I mean, in your defense, I'm hopeful, but I'm not excited for these movies. Everything I've seen, the Fantastic Four, at least they've told us what the story apparently is going to be. It looks like a pretty bare bones superhero story. I'm hopeful about it. I've heard good things from sources. Superman, I'm a little more iffy on, because everything that I've seen from the marketing is like they seem to be scared to tell us what exactly is the main story of this. And I don't know if that's because they're trying to lower the bar so much that people feel more, you know, wowed by the film when they actually get a cohesive story to watch, or what, or maybe they're doing what we always complain about and don't show too much with the trailers. But I'm hopeful, but I absolutely can understand where your trepidation is, because I have those similar trepidations. And the thing is, it's like when we're going on 15 years or so now since we've been had so many of these superhero movies that have dominated the box office in the way they have. And at a certain point, it gets to be like, okay, you need to start showing me like something that really stands out compared to the rest. And by the way, this will be my chance to shout out Thunderbolts, because Thunderbolts does do something different, and was a pleasant surprise. It's a superhero film that tries to tackle themes of loneliness and depression. It doesn't try to be some big CGI fest. So I'll give props to that movie for that. I don't know if we're going to get that from these two films.
Okay, Thunderbolts is exactly what I was going to go to, so good segue, buddy. Here's my criticism, and nerds, go ahead and get mad. Just send your tweet, Four for the Fire, at Gmail, if you want to write a nice long missive about this. These things don't happen in a vacuum. They happen in a sequence. Thunderbolts worked because they did the one in joke with Thunderbolts they had to do to make it work, which was, yeah, we know we're the B-Team Avengers. And they embraced it. And they winked and nodded at it. And they plotline might be a little strong, but it was woven through the whole thing like, no, we know we're the B-Team Avengers. We get it. And they didn't run from it. And they didn't try to pretend like they weren't, and they were on that level, and you had to do that, in my opinion. So people are like, okay, we're all in on the joke now. Let's enjoy the movie. That's a real thing to an audience, especially with a big intellectual property, right? Superman's got this problem where it's just, we've done the man dealing with God thing 20 times now. How are they going to do Fantastic Four where it's not Timu Avengers? And it's not their fault. It's just that's the world we live in. Everybody's seen Avengers Endgame, and you're never going to top that because you're not going to be able to do 15 years worth of movies to build that up again. It's not going to happen again in our lifetime. I don't know that they can overcome it. Thunderbolts could wink and nod at it and bring in a few of the side characters to get around it. But the studios want Avengers every 4 years, and you just can't do that. If they're going to do it with, I think Avengers Doomsday is going to have the same problem. Like, I don't know if people are going to buy the Downey heel turn and all. Like, is that an unfair way to lay it out? Because I think the audience that doesn't know the lore, that you have to teach the lore to, that's how it comes off.
I think the trick is to try to do something that stands out in comparison. Like, I would think, and what I'm hoping from that we get from the movie is that really, instead of trying to get in this instead of like really delving into like going all in on this is like the another Avengers type of thing, what they should do, in my opinion, is really hit the sort of familial aspect of it, really use that. And if you can do that, then you can stand out from other superhero films, particularly superhero team-up films. That's one of the things that really helped make the Guardians films work, is that James Gunn is just so good at doing the whole found family dynamic. So I'm hoping that they do something with that, with Fantastic Four, especially dealing with the whole sort of outsider status, particularly with the Thing.
And the Fantastic Four, because you have a marriage relationship and you have another brother involved. Family dynamics is hard. Let me be fair to the studios here. Action sequences are not easy to write, but they're a lot easier to write than interpersonal dynamics for a wide audience. It's really hard to write, and you're going to write them into an action movie. That's even harder as a writer. That's a really fine tightrope to what you're going to do. And I don't want to give away a plot point here, but apparently she's going to be pregnant in this film. That's a lot of deep interpersonal stuff to try to slam into a superhero movie. If the best you do, it's a challenge.
Yeah. And I would hope that they don't get too crazy with the threats, whatever threat they're facing in the movie, because that could get in the way of them trying to pull that off. Well, it was revealed that the movie is apparently going to be 2 hours and 10 minutes long. That's the longest MCU movie in a couple years now. That's a little concerning, because it makes me wonder if they're just going to go back to sort of doing the big CGI fest at the end. But I'll see what happens. Like I said, I'm hopeful about this movie, but I have some of the same trepidations other people do.
I saw the budget number. There's a CGI fest baked in there somewhere. I promise you. Mendez Movie Report. He does fantastic stuff. Love talking. I didn't even get to the IMAX and movie theater thing. We'll bring that up later, because I think movie theaters are going to move to a premium experience thing, and that's going to change the model. But we'll talk about that next time. Let folks know you got the Substack. You've hauled your brother out to do podcasting again, which is all kinds of fun. Y'all got a fun dynamic going on. You're doing other media. Let folks know what you got going on, where they can follow you.
Just go to MendezMovieReport.com, takes you to my Substack. You could get film reviews, best of lists, Oscar projections, all that kind of stuff. In terms of social media, you can find me over on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, X, Blue Sky, Letterboxd, or even the Award Expert app. Some awards junkies will know what that app is all about. And you can find me under all those under Mendez Movie RPT. Yeah, I'm just, you can find me there, and I'm going to have plenty to talk about now that we're entering the summer box office season.
Yep, and you do a really good job of it, buddy. You keep it level-headed. You don't get into the goofy stuff. I appreciate you greatly. Thank you for your time. We'll do it again soon, sir.
Yep, I'll be back anytime you want me.
That'll be frequently, buddy. Take care. All the music on Her Tell is provided under a creative content license from MonsterCat.com.
Don't you deserve a Medicare plan you can count on? Well, you can count on a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. Enjoy reliable coverage and low out-of-pocket costs with a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. And if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, chronic heart failure, or a cardiovascular disorder, you may qualify for a UnitedHealthcare Complete Care plan with plans that fit your life today and as your needs change tomorrow. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare plans at uhc.com/Medicare.